This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with Chaos! Unintentional or strategic, whether a policy or a law or a deterrent or a whim, it sent politicians scrambling or screaming into the darkness or screaming at each other.
Also say one other thing, these child actors weeping and crying on all the other networks 24/7 right now, do not fall for it, Mr. President.
This is an ideological disagreement between those who believe we should have borders and should have controls and those who believe there should be no borders and no controls. And the bottom line is the president's powers in this area represent the apex of executive authority.
Taking a stand against the White House, American Southwest, Frontier, and United Airlines are all asking the Trump administration to not put migrant children who have been separated from their parents on their flights.
Former head of the Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement warned us that babies and children who have already been separated from their parents under the Trump policy might never, ever be reunited.
I read today about a 10-year-old girl with Down syndrome who was taken from her mother and put in a cage. Read about did you say want to a 10-year-old with Down syndrome
what
being
I
taken
said
from
is
her
you
mother?
Can pick anything
How
you
dare
want
you?
Up with
a stunner. The number of children shipped to New York, some as young as 9 months old, under President Trump's family separation policy, is much, much higher than we could have imagined.
A lot of people yelling at you on TV don't even have children, so don't for a second let them take the moral high ground.
Years old. These are children. For God's sake, America, what's happening to your soul?
One thing in short supply in the fog of outrage was clarity. What, if anything, is the law that Trump first said compelled him to act in such a manner? What's going to happen to the roughly 2,300 missing or relocated children, hundreds of whom were sent to New York City through a private contractor, all unbeknownst to the mayor? What, if anything, was the meaning of Melania's jacket? And what happened to my sense of proportion? We'll take on the first question about the law that Trump said forced him to tear migrant and refugee children from their parents until he decided it didn't. We'll focus on that because it's a way to parse the legal quagmire that confronts those families. Dara Lind has been covering all of this for Vox. She says it begins with a consent decree called Flores.
Jenny Flores came to the U.S. in the 1980s. She was 15. She was coming from El Salvador, fleeing her home country and trying to find an aunt who was living in the U.S. Instead, she got detained in a facility where she was sometimes sharing bathrooms with adult men and women. She was strip searched. The ACLU sued on her behalf and said that there was a constitutional right for, you know, a child who comes to the U.S. without an adult guardian not to be treated like a criminal, but to be released to a responsible adult. And federal courts ultimately agreed that there did need to be separate standards for children who were being held in immigration detention. When President Obama started using widespread detention of immigrant families in 2014, some advocacy groups went back to the Flores Agreement and said that should also apply to children who are being held with their parents in detention. And in 2015, they got a federal judge to agree to extend the Flores Agreement to children who were accompanied when they came to the U.S. and to say that it was unreasonable for them to be held in immigration detention for more than about 20 days. So instead of holding the whole family together for 20 days and then releasing the child and keeping the parents, the government adopted a practice of releasing the entire family together in most cases after a shorter period of time.
Now, you wrote that getting rid of Flores has been in the administration's sights for months.
So several months ago, the Trump administration started raising a big alarm about the loopholes that were in the law. And one of the things that they pointed to was that they had to release families, that they couldn't keep families in immigration detention while their cases were pending. So as there was increased outrage over the family separation that the Trump administration was engaging in for the last several weeks, Republicans led by the Trump administration increasingly started pointing to, well, there's this court settlement that tells us we have to let families go after 20 days. That's why we have to separate them.
So can this rollback of Flores even stand? I mean, the president can't just undo a law with an executive order, can he?
No. And what the executive order says is that, you know, it directed Jeff Sessions and the Department of Justice to file with the judge in the Ninth Circuit who has been overseeing the Flores agreement, Judge Dolly G, and ask her to basically roll back the changes she made in 2015.
They're saying, we are asking you to change your opinion.
Yes, exactly. They gave the judge 19 days to figure out whether or not she's going to reverse her opinion. And if she doesn't make a decision within those 19 days, then the people who got detained on the day the executive order got signed, in theory, will either have to be released or be detained in violation of the existing agreement. So if nothing changes, then the Trump administration has essentially three options. It can release the family and engage in catch and release, which it has made extremely clear it does not see as an option. It can separate the family by releasing the child and keeping the parents, or it can just continue to defy the law and basically dare the courts to step in and tell them that they're defying the law. We did get a hint of what they consider the right option to be. In their filing at the Ninth Circuit to try to change the Flores decree, they said that if the family could not be detained together, ICE would be required, or rather, ICE is required to separate the family, which does give us a hint that that's what they see the alternative as being.
Mm-hmm. There's also an opportunity here to frame the issue as either you do it my way, or you're throwing open the borders and everybody can come in with their drugs and their worst people and their rapists and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, the Trump administration definitely thinks that they're putting pressure on both Judge G and Congress right now. After the executive order got signed, Department of Justice advisor Gene Hamilton, who's close to Jeff Sessions, had a press call where he said explicitly, Judge G is going to have to make a choice about whether families can be detained. And simultaneously was saying, well, the House has two bills in front of them this week. Both of them would codify the government's ability to keep families in detention. They would override the Flores decision. So if Congress wants to fix the problem, that's what it can do. This is not the first time that they've done something as a way to pressure Congress into doing something. That's what they tried when they tried to rescind the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they've said whenever anyone has had any problems with their immigration enforcement tactics, is that if people don't like the laws, they have to change the laws. They absolutely think that they're pulling a strategic move that is going to result in them getting what they want.
Mm-hmm.
They have thus far extremely totally failed at getting what they want from Congress.
What happens if Trump decides to take the third option you posited and continue to separate families, violate Flores? I mean, who do we send out? The National Guard against ICE?
Yeah, I mean, in theory, under this logic, it's not just that Trump continues to detain families for, you know, a 21st day. It's he continues to detain families. Someone files a motion with Judge G. She tells him to freaking stop doing that. The Ninth Circuit tells them to stop doing that, goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court says, you have to stop. You have to release families. Now, that does raise a question, given the conservative turn of the Supreme Court, as to whether, if it got to that level, the Supreme Court would in fact say that the 2015 expansion of Flores was bad and that it shouldn't apply to children who are here with their parents. But assuming that the Supreme Court said you have to release families and Trump refused to do it, yeah, you have an Andrew Jackson-level constitutional crisis on your hands. That said, and I say this as someone who is well aware that the Trump administration has often been cavalier in its interest in the legalities of whether it can do something before it does it, they have abided by court orders that have told them to stop doing things consistently. You know, when the courts ordered them to reopen the DACA program, they did that. When they were told to not defund sanctuary cities, they've complied with that. Even the order that the president has to not block people on Twitter, somebody went through and unblocked everybody. The thing that is important to remember there, though, is that they don't have to be in violation of Flores. They do not appear to see the family separation option as totally dead. Even the executive order does not actually say anything about not being able to separate families. It explicitly says that families should still be separated when the government deems it necessary for public safety. So they wouldn't have to engage in constitutional crisis. They could just return to the policy that they've engaged in and kind of cross their fingers and hope that this time nobody gets as mad because they tried to do something else and were thwarted.
Dara Lind is a senior reporter at Vox, where she focuses on immigration. Now we'll pick up on her last point, that the Trump White House may simply carry on as it has, all the while banking on the assumption that protest will be stilled by emotional exhaustion. And so it may be, according to a recent Pew study, for people on both sides of the political divide. Exhausting and familiar and perilous. As Slate columnist and host of the podcast Amicus, Dahlia Lithwick, observes.
A year and a half ago, the initial travel ban, when everyone went out to the airports and just sat there at baggage claim, I can't imagine what it would take for us to do that again. But what's happening to these children at the borders is vastly worse. So we're changing. It's not as though the actions are more benign and our response is to go numb.
Let me play you this from David Frum of The Atlantic. He made this point a couple of weeks ago on CNN.
There may be things that newsrooms can do differently or better to help people keep better track of the stories, but it's also your responsibility as a citizen. And you can't put your responsibilities on the press and say, why didn't you make this easier for me or more entertaining? Why didn't you make the news less frightening than it really is? I would like a different truth, please. The job of the press is to tell you the truth as it is, whether it's good news or not. And then it's your responsibility as a patriot and as a citizen to accept it and to internalize it and to act on it.
So he's saying, stop blaming the press. But has the press contributed to this insanity?
I think that the press is the cause of and also the solution to the insanity, Brooke. I think that certainly the press has a lot to answer for in terms of election coverage, campaign coverage. They'll be writing books about that forever. The breathless hanging on every Trump tweet and every salacious and ridiculous thing he says in order to get attention. We have certainly, I think, been complicit. But I have to agree with my fellow Canadian David Frum. I think that we are doing our very best under circumstances that have no analog, at least in my lifetime. And I think that to say, oh, the press is paying too much attention to Stormy Daniels or Michael Avenatti or too much attention to the tweets or the Russia scandal, whatever the complaint is, my answer is yes, and we have to pay attention to all of it and take it in and figure out our lane. That doesn't mean getting exhausted or getting depressed or drinking yourself into a stupor every night by 6 o'clock. But it does mean, I think, not faulting the press for doing their level best. It means find press that's meaningful to you, that's doing work you support on issues you care about, and pay them and support them and reward them.
The greatest challenge, perhaps, is not just keeping up with the news and mobilizing, but sustaining the energy, even when the results don't seem to materialize. This gets to what Masha Gessen called outrage fatigue in a conversation we had back in January.
What we saw in January of last year with the travel ban was a textbook example of how democracy should work. The president did something abhorrent, and formal and informal institutions kicked into gear at the same time. So we saw civil society putting pressure on the judiciary and stopping the travel ban. And then Trump put forward travel ban 2.0, and the institutions were a little bit fatigued, but were able to resist. And then travel ban 3.0, and the resistance was partial, but it still worked. And by the time travel ban 4.0 rolled around, nobody noticed.
you can see even the judges getting tired. You know, judges who were horrified the first time they were hearing these cases are more and more of the view that, yeah, yeah, so he tweeted awful things. So there's another layer that's a little scary, which is that social media gives us the illusion that we've acted because we click like, right? Because we tweet something and we post something. And then we think it's like going to a march. And I think we have to remind ourselves that all the shruggy emoji guys in the world are not political action.
Dahlia, I don't know. You sound kind of like an activist.
I always tell people I'm the most small-c conservative radical you'll ever meet. I look at my kids and I think they just cannot grow up in the world where people are hearing a president say that we are infested with immigrants. So, yes, I am so poorly constructed for this, but I think I got to do it anyway.
Dahlia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus.
Coming up, the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy was meant to send a message. But what message was received?
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The tape of sobbing children obtained and released by ProPublica this week didn't only reverberate in the U.S. Carlos Dada is an editor at El Faro, a digital newspaper based in El Salvador, and he says the recording and all the other reports about separated parents and children are changing the way Central Americans are seeing their relationship with us.
I have to tell you that Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador are some of the countries where the United States is a very popular country. But now we hear and see our children crying. This has caused an unprecedented wave of anger against the United States.
Well, you're describing public outrage and grief and pain. But then there's the governments of Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, who have been markedly less demonstrative in their reactions. Why?
Because, of course, the United States is such a huge power and its influence is so big that no one wants to be in a fight with the United States. Take, for example, Honduras. Its president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, was reelected November last year through what every single international organization considered a fraud. But he's there because his fraud was approved by the United States, and he is held in that position by the United States. Take Guatemala. Its president's party has been accused of corruption. It's being investigated by a United Nations commission, and he's asking the United States to stop fueling money to this United Nations commission. El Salvador is a bit more independent, but we still depend on some foreign aid that the United States sends. So that explains a bit why popular outrage has not found an equivalent among Central American governments.
The spokesman for the president of Guatemala had told the press that Guatemala respects the United States' application of law in its immigration policy, and it created an uproar.
Yes, indeed. The answer from the whole Guatemalan society was anger because it's Guatemalan children there. So the president was obliged to fire him the next day and said they were fixing a new position of the Guatemalan government, taking back those statements.
And what about the media? Many newspapers and TV stations, radio stations, are heavily influenced, let's say, by their governments. How vocal have they been in deploring Trump's conduct?
Oh, very vocal. I mean, this is just too much, Bob. I mean, since Trump came into office, if you remember, he announced his candidacy speaking ugly, very ugly things against Mexicans and Central Americans. And we see this basically as a racist measure. He said just 2 days ago that all these immigrants are criminals bound to infest the United States. And let me just add, if you allow me, just one more thing. These parents, with their children, have already taken a very dangerous path to get to the U.S. they don't do this because they like to cause some suffering in their children. They do this because they are desperate. They are running away from risks and dangers posed in these countries. So that's why they are there. When they arrive there, the children are already traumatized. These are some of the most violent countries on earth. Let's take gangs, for example, in El Salvador. A lot of urban communities are controlled by gangs. That means that a gang leader decides whether you can go to school or not. A gang leader decides how much you have to pay as an extortion for them to allow you to leave. A gang leader decides whether he likes your daughter or not, which means whether he's going to take her by force or not. A gang leader basically decides who leaves and who doesn't.
This is a classic root cause situation. You can try to deter all you want, but unless these societies are somehow made less threatening to citizens, illegal migration will continue. What, if anything, is being done? What can be done?
Well, the United States should stop supporting corruption in Central America, which the United States has been doing for years, which allows criminal mafias to be in power in some of our countries. By the way, this is not the United States' sole responsibility. Our politicians have not been doing their homework, that's for sure. The United States should be helping to think about more long-term solutions and not politically convenient immediate solutions that bring nowhere.
Carlos, thank you so much.
Bob, thank you. Thank you for giving me the chance to. I hope I was able to control my anger.
You did splendidly under the circumstances. Carlos Dada is editor of El Faro, a digital newspaper based in El Salvador. The problem is that for our current president, short-term solutions are kind of the name of the game, aided, says Francisco Balderrama, by a heaping helping of historical ignorance.
Obviously, we have an individual who doesn't have an understanding of history, in particular the great repatriations of the 1930s.
Francisco Balderrama is co-author of A Decade of Betrayal, Mexican Repatriation in the 1930s, about a mostly forgotten chapter of U.S. history. We spoke with him in 2015, and he reminded us that during the stress of the Great Depression, U.S. officials undertook a mass expulsion of Mexican immigrants and their American-born children in precisely the manner and for precisely the reasons being championed by Trump.
Using the same language, people talked about the expulsion of Mexicans and frequently invoking the notion or the idea that we'll keep the families together. And by keeping the families together, obviously unconstitutionally deporting American citizens of Mexican descent who are American citizens by birth.
Tell me first about its scale.
Well, we're talking about conservatively over 1 million Mexican nationals. About 60% of those were U.S. citizens, either because they were children or they were spouses of Mexican nationals during that moment. And we have it occurring throughout the United States, from the American Southwest to the Midwest to the Deep South, Pacific Northwest, also including Alaska. Especially in the winter of 1930-1931, the Hoover administration conducted very publicized raids. Here in Los Angeles, we had the infamous Placita raid in downtown Los Angeles. Businesses, U.S. Steel, Southern Pacific Railroad, Ford Motor Company, these companies sought to decline their workforce by focusing on Mexicans and providing transportation for Mexicans to leave the country. At the same time, on the local level, the different counties, the different states, then took it into their own hands to round up individuals, frequently referring to that we're going to cut charities, we're going to cut relief by shipping Mexicans home.
That itself sounds awfully familiar. There is today a lot of rhetoric about the cost of supporting an immigrant population. Is it a direct parallel? This did all take place, of course, in the depths of the Great Depression.
Los Angeles had the largest Mexican concentration in the United States. and most of the Mexican population have been longtime residents of L.A. County, about 60% for quite a time, and were on welfare no more than a year or so. We found about 40% of them. In other words, Mexicans never constituted that much of the welfare population, and it also raised serious questions that even with their expulsion, would that have produced, to use the words of the 1930s, that many jobs for Americans?
You made reference to the raid at La Placita in 1931 in downtown L.A. Tell me about it. Was it an atrocity? Was it like the raid on Stonewall in Greenwich Village in the 60s? Was it Kristallnacht? What was it?
I think it's more of a declaration of the attitude of American society. By targeting this particular area, the historic core of the city, the Mexican population had been involved with the founding of the city and the development of the city. They're making a declaration here that Mexicans are not wanted, that Mexicans are not a part of the society. Rather, they are disposable labor. We use them in good economic times, and we get rid of them in bad economic times if we need to do that. And the Placita raid underscores that. And because Los Angeles had this great concentration, it becomes kind of the model. We don't call it deportation. We call it repatriation. We organize trains. That's the way we get rid of the Mexicans.
Your late co-author, Raymond Rodriguez, testified at a California State Senate hearing in 2003 about his personal history.
In many cases, families were split. That happened in our family. My dad left in 1936, when I was 10, I never saw my dad again.
How big a profile did this program have? Was the American public even aware that this was going on? Was it an issue? Was it a controversy? Was it a debate?
It's not so much a debate. It's rather an accepted idea. This is really what's best for them, to go to Mexico where they belong. There is in some of the documentation, every once in a while, some official remarking, well, these are U.S. citizens. Sometimes supervisors saying, it doesn't make any difference. They're all Mexicans. We want to keep the families together. So just proceed with their so-called repatriation. The federal government, as we go into the Roosevelt years and the New Dealers, they're pretty blind to this. Much like later on, they're blind to the placement of Japanese Americans in concentration camps.
Has this episode even shown up in textbooks?
Well, it has been a part of the teaching of Chicano history and Chicano studies. But in mainstream U.S. history courses, sometimes the only reference to Mexicans and Latinos is the obligatory reference to Cesar Chavez. But no understanding of this. There has been passage just last week of AB 146 here in the state of California that, if signed by the governor, encourages the teaching of unconstitutional deportation of the 1930s in California schools. The state of California in 2006 recognized it and offered an apology. That apology was memorialized with a monument right at the site of the Placita raid. That understanding of it, that knowledge of it, that teaching of it, I think is a good insurance policy in terms of not having this outrageous type of public policy implemented.
Francisco, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Francisco Balderrama is professor of history and Chicano studies at California State University, Los Angeles. He is the co-author, with the late Raymond Rodriguez, of Decade of Betrayal, Mexican Repatriation in the 1930s.
Coming up, what America was and is going back through the eights, as in 1948, 58, 68. 78.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We are who we are because of who we were and where we've been. This week's disheartening display is a legacy. Some could trace it to the nation's founding, but its direct ancestor was born in the middle of the last century. This is the stuff of culture war. It is a war of backlash in the name of God, family, public safety, and national security against the ascension of civil rights, secularization, political correctness, and other affronts to so-called traditional values. WNYC's Morning Call-In Show, hosted by Brian Lehrer, has documented the past six decades of culture war for a new series called The Eights. Brian, formerly the host of this very show, comes back for a visit. Hey, man.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
What happened in 48? And I'm thinking actually specifically of Eleanor Roosevelt.
So in 1948, there seemed to be a tremendous amount of national unity. We were coming out of a few decades of the rolling traumas of the Great Depression and World War II. People wanted to start families and settle down and all that stuff. We were trying to lead the world in establishing norms of international behavior as well as norms of international trade. So the World Trade Organization was formed in 1948. There was also, in the very first years of the United Nations, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
This may well become the international Magna Carta of all men everywhere.
It's hard to see what might have been controversial about human rights declarations, except for maybe this. Our own nation was in violation. We were deeply segregated. Justice was white only. There was a certain physician heal thyself character to this declaration, no?
Certainly, there was all this pent-up demand, if you want to call it demand, among African Americans for this moment that had maybe been squashed by the Depression and by World War II, those rolling national traumas. But now, if there was relative peace and tranquility and relative prosperity, there was more room in our politics for the civil rights movement to break out.
A couple other things that were going on in 48, the House Un-American Affairs Committee was in the spotlight, a petri dish for the Red Scare that would so dominate the 50s. And then there was this new household appliance, television. And both of those things would, in their own ways, define kind of opposite self-images for Americans.
Maybe in that moment of apparent relative national unity after World War II, something like McCarthyism had to break out. Maybe it's just human nature for people to look for the enemies within. And with respect to television, it's funny. One of the things that I expected to hear from some of our oldest listeners calling in who remembered the advent of television in 1948 was that it started to atomize us. And I thought people would say, oh, television, everybody started looking at their screens. Instead, people talked about how television united them with their neighbors in those very earliest days when not that many people had televisions.
In order to see the Milton Berle show, I had to go around the corner to a friend's apartment. She wasn't a close friend, but she became my friend. I courted her so that I would be invited to see the Milton Berle show on Tuesday nights. That was my only way to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
so let's skip ahead just 10 years. 1958. The context was historic prosperity, utter economic domination in the world, and our wistful memories, speaking of television, seem to coincide with Leave It to Beaver suburban tranquility. But as author Fred Kaplan told you, alienation was breaking through.
A key moment happened on January 2nd of 59, was that the Russians launched a rocket called the Lunik, also called Mishta, which meant dream. And this was the first rocket that broke through the gravitational pull of the Earth and started rotating around the sun like a planet. Now, this was made a big deal. Time magazine referred to this as a turning point in the multi-billion-year history of the universe.
A lot of things, in a way, were getting ready to break out of their orbits. You could see it in space, you could see it in jazz, you could see it in poetry, and you could see it in the way the civil rights movement was continuing apace. By 1958, it should have been becoming clear, if it wasn't, that that movement would not stop.
By 1968, the level of societal alienation had actually become a metric. Tell me about the Harris Poll, please.
The Harris Poll began in 1966, and one of the things that they did was ask people almost every year five questions that had to do with how alienated they felt, and they called it the Alienation Index. So questions like how much they feel heard by people in power. And in 1966, the Alienation Index out of 100 was what we would now consider very low. It was 29, and it went up and up through the late 60s and early 70s, and it never came back down. And people were getting alienated in polarized directions. So there was the Timothy Leary style, drop out, tune in, turn on.
Don't politic, don't vote. These are old men's games, impotent and senile old men that want to put you onto their old chess games of war and power. Drop out.
At the same time, people with more traditional values felt like the world was starting to get away from them. The Supreme Court had issued rulings limiting prayer in schools. The counterculture seemed to not respect traditional markers of authority. Spiro Agnew,
Nixon's vice president and proto-culture warrior,
really started to express that.
The student now goes to college to proclaim rather than to learn. The lessons of the past are ignored and obliterated in a contemporary antagonism known as the generation gap. A spirit of national masochism prevails, encouraged by an effete core of impudent snobs who characterize themselves as intellectuals.
The culture wars really broke out in the 70s. As feminism was rising, there was a backlash by people who were concerned about the breakdown of the family and the loss of traditional roles. Evangelical churches that had previously felt it was their obligation to stay out of politics started to feel like it was their obligation to get in. So we got Jerry Falwell as a public figure by around 1978.
Abortion is not a Roman Catholic issue. It is a moral issue that concerns the human rights of unborn babies who, by the hundreds of thousands, are being murdered.
And that movement helped fuel Ronald Reagan's presidential candidacy of 1980 and helped propel him to that victory.
I want to skip to 1988. This was the year that presidential candidate George H.W. Bush derided his opponent Michael Dukakis.
Then he said, "I am a card-carrying member of the ACLU.
It was the year that Rush Limbaugh went on the air nationally.
Your guiding light through times of trouble, confusion, murkiness, and despair, Rush Limbaugh.
Then there was Pat Buchanan, the founding conservative voice on CNN's political sparring show, Crossfire, who further burnished his resume by actually putting a name to the culture wars.
There is a religious war going on in this country. It is a cultural war as critical to the kind of nation we shall be as the Cold War itself, for this war is for the soul of America.
One thing we learned by Crossfire and the cable TV politics that would follow was that Gil Scott-Heron was wrong. The revolution would be televised. And this gets us to 1998, the Clinton administration, the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal, the Starr Report. They were made for, and I would argue perhaps maybe made by, TV events.
Good morning. Welcome to Fox News Channel.
This is Fox News started in 1996 in the environment where Bill Clinton was sort of this lightning rod for everything from the 1960s culture wars that people could choose up sides over, draft dodging, pot smoking. And it culminated, of course, in the 1998 televised spectacle of the impeachment, but not removal from office.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
One of the really interesting things to me about Clinton was that he was trying to strike a bargain, a sort of center-left bargain that would end the culture wars of the 1960s and 1970s. He gave the right its due, as he expressed it, on some of the things that really disturbed a lot of people around the country, like crime. And so there was the big crime bill, which now we look back as having helped to start mass incarceration. There was welfare and the big welfare reform of 1996 that Clinton and the Newt Gingrich Congress came to yes on. But he was really trying to be the one who ended the culture wars, and it really, really failed. I don't know if this is jumping ahead too much to 2008, but when Obama came in after his iconic speech at the 2004 Democratic Convention.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
And came in with some things that he thought were going to be compromises with the right, like cap and trade to fight climate change, a market-based solution that the right had kind of endorsed, and Obamacare, which had been Romneycare. But like with Clinton's attempts to compromise, the right would not have it.
The 2008 election was another inflection point. It seemed like we were at least heading in the direction of a post-racial world. Yet that pesky Harris poll and its alienation index showed something that maybe wasn't apparent at the time, but is certainly in retrospect very, very clear.
Remember, it had started in the first year of the Alienation Index, 1966, at just 29 out of 100. And through the Obama years, it went up every year and peaked at 70 out of 100 in 2014, and then the same thing in 2016. The Harris Alienation Index saw it in almost every group. Certainly the financial crisis, which had started in earnest in 2008, drew the Tea Party on the right, but also the Occupy movement on the left seeing too much corporate power in America, the right seeing too much liberal cultural power. Those were all still in play. There was certainly the extra factor of a black man in the White House, the undercurrents of racism that allowed a lot of white Americans to believe the birther claims. All of these were peaking at the same time.
And so here we are, present day. Now, the Harris poll still measures alienation, but the Brian Lehrer Show commissioned a poll to study what, if anything, could possibly unify Americans. And in this week's broadcasts, you delivered some findings.
Yes, and I think the chronic nature of the culture wars get revealed in various ways in the poll. For example, we asked, who does more good than harm? Who does more harm than good in America today? And tested various groups of people. So 49% said the Trump administration is doing more harm than good. That's right down the middle. We also tested the perception of people with ideas you might associate with Trump supporters, people who thought the president is the victim of a witch hunt. 47% said people who think that are doing more harm than good. Americans who think white people are often discriminated against, which would be a lot of Trump supporters, 43% said they're doing more harm than good. Members of the NRA, 42% said more harm than good. Anything within 10 points of 50-50 reads to me like a battleground issue, not a consensus. Similarly, when we asked who's doing more good than harm, 53% said teachers around the country striking for better pay. So it's over 50, but it's just barely over 50, so that's divisive. 42% said feminists and Me Too activists more good than harm. Just 38% said gun control activists were doing more good than harm. None of these things hit 70%, 80%, 90%. And so many of what we think of as the cultural fault lines today were hitting those divisive 40s and 50s.
Common ground is slim pickings.
But it's not entirely absent. Almost 90% of respondents said they would feel more included, less alienated, if health insurance and healthcare costs were more affordable. 71% said more laws to prevent climate change. That's very interesting. But when they try anything in particular to do it, it turns out to be very divisive. And over 80% said they would feel more included if women had more power and respect in society. Even 70% of men said that. So in theory, there are places where there are opportunities for unity.
There was a moment in the series when you said something that was perfectly reasonable, but also it struck me as a perfect microcosm of our nation's struggle. It sounded like this.
I mean, one way to look at this whole history of post-World War II America that we've been doing these last 6 weeks is that it's a history of social progress and backlash, and social progress and backlash.
Well, I agree. Civil rights, Miranda warnings, secularization, desegregation, globalism, social welfare, I call that social progress. But there is a very large cohort of Americans who view that same list as social retreat, social decline, social engineering, government interference, even tyranny. And the very fact that you and me and our fellow so-called elites see the word progress as a given, not as, say, a viewpoint, is a major source of the alienation and the rage.
What you and I might more easily call social progress than some other people would, many of those things tend to get accepted over time. So, for example, many people who feel alienated by the Black Lives Matter movement today would probably not argue that Jim Crow laws of the Old South should still be in effect in the United States. I think we see it in terms of gay rights, too. That was such a culture war's lightning rod, but I think we've started to move toward a national consensus that legal gay marriage is more good than bad. How many people think anymore that there should be separate listings in the want ads for men's jobs and women's jobs? So I think progress and backlash is a legitimate model for looking at so many things that then start to be seen as basic respect of individuals.
Well, optimism noted. And yet, having listened, binged actually, to your programs in the last few days, it seems to me that your voice betrayed a kind of melancholy, if not abject despair. Where has this exercise of chronicling the evolution of the culture wars left you as a broker of ideas and just as a citizen?
It has left me somewhat melancholy about those things that seem so resistant to change. And they go right back to America's original sin, which is the legacy of slavery and the way white people view black people. And today, with the immigration wars, black and brown people in general. There is a more optimistic framework, however, through which we could look at the present. And it actually happens in the county of my birth, Queens, New York, which is maybe the most diverse place in America. It's about 45% foreign-born. And a caller to the final segment in the series said, look at Queens as a model of America for 10 years from now, 2028.
As we blend as a nation, we will get to know one another. I don't think I'm being Pollyanna. All you have to do is walk through Queens. If you're a racist in Queens, you would have to kill yourself. So there you have it.
In Queens, people basically get along. It's not the Tower of Babel. But if you're a racist in Queens, you're going to be the one who's ostracized. And maybe that's the United States of tomorrow.
From that caller's lips to God's ears. Brian, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure, Bob.
Brian Lehrer is the host of The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, which this week concluded a series on the history of the culture wars. It's titled The Eights. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Michael Loewinger, Leah Feder, and John Hanrahan. We had more help from Kate Brown and Meg Harney, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.